Europe is at a crossroads. For decades, it seems as if the old continent was only getting more freer and more democratic, but now it's an open question if many Europeans even want to preserve democracy anymore. Is Europe, the birthplace of democracy, now starting to give up on democracy? We spoke to a representative of the Varieties of Democracies Institute in Sweden to l learn more on today's Trumpet World.
In mid-April, Hungarians will decide which direction to take, toward liberal democracy or an authoritarian model inspired by Russia.
Meloni's hard right government wants to change Italy's constitution to separate the role of judges and prosecutors and reform their oversight body. The prime minister says the plan is essential to guarantee impartiality. Critics, though, condemn it as a political power grab that fails to address the real challenges in the justice system, from years-long trials to prison overcrowding.
The German far right is celebrating again. The AfD secured their best score ever in a Western German state, and a closer look at the numbers suggests it's not a one-off.
That was a little sampling of different political turning points, some would say crises, hitting Europe currently. Welcome back to Trumpet World. I'm Mihailo Zdekic, filling in for your usual host, Mr. Richard Palmer. It has been quite a year so far for externally. The war between the United States and Iran has definitely impacted Europe with rising oil prices and even member states like Cyprus getting involved. But it's also been a great year so far of internal turmoil within Europe. In February, Politico put out this bombshell headline, quote, "One in five Europeans say dictatorship might be preferable," end quote. As that article shows, the data is a little more nuanced than that, but still reflective of deep political fissures within European society, not just in one country, but continent-wide. Last week, we saw a couple of major events hit that demonstrate this. On March 22nd in state elections in the German state of Rhineland-Palatinate, the neo-Nazi Alternative for Deutschland scored its largest ever result in former West Germany at about 20%. That's about the third biggest party in those elections. Meanwhile, that same day and the next day, voters in Italy rejected a referendum sponsored by Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni to constitutionally revise Italy's judicial system. The actual subject of the referendum was a bit bureaucratic, but it was part of a wider system of constitutional reforms Meloni has been trying to push to cement more power into the executive, aka herself. This first referendum was seen as a test if she could continue with the program, although it failed from 54 to 46. Given the context, the fact that it even started in the first place could be a cause for concern. Next month, meanwhile, Hungary is having their own parliamentary elections, which is widely seen as a referendum on Prime Minister Viktor Orban and his democratic erosions in Hungary since 2010. There's a lot going on in Europe, again, not just in one country, but all over the place, and how, whether one's living in the thick of it or observing from the outside, how is one supposed to make sense of all of this? Well, the Varieties of Democracy Institute, or simply the VDEM Institute, is a research institute affiliated with the University of Gothenburg in Sweden. Through correlating data sent in from a variety of experts all around the world and measuring it with the same metrics, the VDEM Institute has been publishing an annual index on the state of democracy in the world and freedom in the world, looking at countries on a case-by-case basis and comparing the data in general. They've been doing this for about a decade, but their work in analyzing these trends has been going on far longer than that. They are subsequently respected worldwide as one of the most accurate annual reportings on the state of freedom in the world. They released their 2026 report on March 17th entitled Unraveling the Democratic World? An ominous title there, and we spoke with Marina Nord, a postdoctoral research fellow at the Institute who partially supervised the research that went into that report. We spoke about the trends of democratic backsliding in Europe specifically, as a general trend, while zooming into a few countries as case studies. Please note that as we start, the interview has been slightly condensed during the editing process for fluidity, but with all that being said, enjoy. So first off, thank you again very much for agreeing to speak with us. As an introduction, if you'd like, could you summarize how the VDEM Institute came to be, what its methodology is with its research, how you came to be involved in the program, etc.?
Well, as you all probably know, VDEM stands for Varieties of Democracy. That means there are different ideas of how democracy can be measured. So the core principle, which is at the core of any democracy measure, is free and fair elections. And everything that's surrounding the elections, that means freedom of expression, freedom of association, freedom to form parties and participate in elections. And then on top of that, there are different discussions in the academic literature, what else belongs to democracy apart from elections. And that's why we came with different versions of measuring democracy. We have five different indices: liberal, egalitarian, participatory, and deliberative democracy, on top of electoral democracy index. The one that became the most prominently known because of the democracy report is the liberal democracy index. This is the one on which the democracy report is built. And that means that on top of having free and fair elections, to be a liberal democracy, you also need to have true separation of powers. So so the executive should be constrained by the legislative branch and by the judiciary branch. And there should be also true protection of civil rights and protection, respect for rule of law in the country. So that's the liberal democracy index that we measure, that we use in the democracy report. And with this, This is the one when we talk about global trends, this is the index that we use.
Okay, and for the actual institute itself, you are affiliated with the University of Gothenburg. How did the birth of your institution come to be?
Well, just to explain, the headquarters of the VDEM Institute, of the VDEM project, is located in the University of Gothenburg. This is VDEM Institute, but VDEM is a large academic network. So we have five different copies. Only two of them are located in Sweden, one in Norway and two in the United States. We have more than 100 project managers. Each of them is responsible for different part of methodology. And we have also nine regional centers, the ones who are responsible for recruiting experts, and we use more than 4,000 experts. And something that I need to repeat every time I present VDEM Institute, it's not people who sit in Sweden who decide how each country is measured. So we use experts who are academics and who are located in countries for which they are providing experts, for majority of them. And it's never one single expert who assesses the whole country. They're experts on specific things, say they're expert on civil society in the United Kingdom, or they're expert on constitutional law. And so they rate only a specific part of the only some specific indicators that go into the index. And for each indicator, you need at least five experts. And then the whole information is aggregated using the statistical model tool. And then we use supercomputers here in Sweden and Linköping to aggregate the data, taking into account disagreements between experts, biases of experts, and all other things. So it's a very rigorous methodology. So we people who sit in Sweden, we are only responsible for aggregating the data and then eventually analyzing the data for the democracy report. But we are not the ones who decide how each rating each country receives. And the Vidom Institute, sorry, I always forget your questions. Vidom Institute was, it started as a collaboration between several researchers in the late, I'm not sure because I was not then part of the Vidom Institute, honestly, but it was 2008 or 2009 when the first discussion started. And then in 2012, the first funding was received to create what started as a project. And then in 2014, the Vidom Institute itself was funded, and it was located at the University of Gothenburg because the major funder at that moment, Riksbanken Jubileums Fund, came from Sweden. But it's not the only funder. We have different funding. Most of them is from research and academic funding. But most of them come from the European Union or European countries, but also several other international projects.
Earlier in March, the Institute released its annual report on the state of democracy of the world, and you entitled it Unraveling the Democratic Era. Did you have any particular major reason why you named the general state of the world after that?
Well, there were two reasons, at least in my opinion. My co-authors may disagree, but there are two things that we saw in the data this year. First is that the global democratic decline continues, and it deepens. It has been going on for at least 25 years, and now at least a quarter of all countries in the world are affected. If you look backwards, how many countries were in total affected, the ones that have already stabilized, then it's almost a half of the world were affected by this. So we think it's a fundamental shift, and we see that it's a lot of major countries are affected, the ones that are populous, economically powerful, and large in territory. So the ones that are driving this trend. And that means that we see some kind of global shift in powers, and also maybe the defining change of the global order on how the world is governed. So we see that there is now a trend towards becoming more autocratic, and this is something that's happening globally. It's not that specific regions are affected. And then the second reason is that we see now that this global trend of autocratization has reached one of the major strongholds of democracy in the world, the United States. And the consequences for the world are, of course, maybe quite tremendous. It's very hard to predict at the moment what they will be, but we know that what's happening in the United States might affect everyone on the planet.
You had some interesting statistics in your latest report about Europe that I wanted to focus on. And you divide Eastern Europe and Western Europe into two different sections. I think it's fair to say Eastern Europe has always struggled with issues like corruption for many years now. But aside from perennial democratic backsliders like Hungary, in this report, you mentioned different developments like Slovakia losing its status as a liberal democracy. You mentioned Bulgaria is very close to doing so as well. It seems like the trend of autocratization of, as you mentioned, the an unrestrained executive power, removal of separation of powers, of constitutional guarantees, those seem to be trending region-wide. In fact, a quote from your report reads, quote, Eastern Europe now appears roughly similar to sub-Saharan Africa in terms of the share of population living in democracies, end quote. At least for me, that is a very startling assessment. Are there any common factors or drivers behind this trend?
Well, first, just to give some statistics about Eastern Europe, we see now that 11 countries are autocratizing and only two are democratizing. And out of the ones that are democratizing, one of them is Poland, is recovering from recent democratic backsliding. So it's something to keep in mind. And now also Western Europe, as you said, is affected, and major players in Western Europe are affected. Countries like the United Kingdom and Italy are now also facing some democratic decline. So for a long time, we saw that Hungary, and we thought that Hungary was an exception, right? So it was one of those few countries in Europe that were autocratizing, and it was something, you know, It was explained as something that can happen only in a specific combination, under a specific combination of circumstances. But then other countries started to join. First, it was Poland under Law and Justice parties. And then for several years, we saw on what we call watch list or risk zone, such countries as Slovakia and Slovenia. Bulgaria, as you mentioned, there is also on this list. And then suddenly there were some deteriorations continuing in these countries as well. And some of them, most notably Slovakia, have now joined the list of autocratizers. It's very hard to say what the specific reasons for these are, because it's always a combination of factors that play. So it's not like, you know, the single thing that is responsible for everything. So you should think about it as supply and demand problem. So supply is what happens on the elite side, so that we have so many far-right populist parties, populist leaders who drive this decline. And the moment they come to power, where they start to dismantle democracy from within. So Viktor Orban is, of course, one of the most prominent figures, the one that everyone has studied the most thoroughly, I think, from the academic community. So elected through free and fair elections, the moment he came to power, he started very gradually, very slowly, but to dismantle the democratic system from within. It went through different laws through the parliament. It was approved and supported by his party, of course. And then it was like very, very narrow. So it's very hard to notice for the population, especially during the first years, because it's like tiny, tiny steps with which you dismantle democracy, restrictions on freedom of expression there, then restrictions on operation of civil society there. And since it's so marginal from year to year, it's very hard to notice, you know, that even on our date, if you compare Hungary for 1 year to previous year, that's like only minimal change. But over years, over a decade, it aggregates into a substantial decline. And at some point, Hungary was, you know, more or less unique in Europe, at least as a country. So the only comparison we had here, a similar one, was Poland then in 2015 when Law and Justice parties came to power. But then it suddenly became, you know, this urbanization of politics in Eastern Europe. It became very much pronounced because suddenly that many, many leaders started to follow this pattern. And the reason for that, it may be because there is a second factor. This is what I call the demand for this populist, right-wing populist politics. This is something that happens within the population. And this is unfortunately something that we researchers do not understand well enough why it's happening, because there are many ideas and many, in many, you know, kind of factors that the research community brings up. First of all, economic inequality or dissatisfaction with how some economic problems are dealt with and that the government doesn't solve it. Sometimes it's dissatisfaction with how some migration issues are dealt with, growing corruption, and then again unhappiness about the government. But then it is also something that's happening within the social values of the society, and then changing social values. And then again, some kind of contradictions between like who we are. So for some reason, there is something within the society that the society feels unhappy about. And those populist leaders, they come to power by claiming that they know how to solve this specific issue. That they know how to address, you know, corruption. They know who is to blame for the fact that you have corruption in this and that country. Sometimes they claim that they have the solution for whatever rising economic, for all these economic problems that you have in country. And again, they are the only one who knows how to solve it, that there are specific elites who are to blame for that. And they are, you know, kind of becoming treated as enemies of the people, you know, in a certain way. Usually when they come to power with this populist rhetoric, they also use often quite a lot of disinformation, picking up some news, you know, and like interpreting them in a different way. and driving something that became also very popular, like polarization in the society, because there is part of the society that supports them and the other part of the society that is definitely against those populist leaders. And then when you drive polarization in the society, it's easier, you know, to pinpoint that we have enemies within the country, you know, they are foreign agents, they are beholden to the foreign powers or something like that. And so this rhetoric helps them to get to power. And it also helps them the moment they are in power to dismantle democratic institutions from within, because they always have an explanation why this or this law needs to be imposed, like why we need restrictions on civil society, why we need restrictions on freedom of speech, and so on and so on. So I think that we as an academic community still haven't found, you know, this good explanation of what exactly drives. So we know quite a lot about how it happens. We know quite a lot how this sequence of attacks happens. For example, we know that it usually starts with attacks on freedom of expression, attacks on civil society, then attacks on what we call horizontal accountability. This is checks and balances on the executive power. We know, again, from the research and the way, for example, Viktor Orban did it, how they do it. It's done through purges in the judiciary, through purges in the legislative branch, that you impose in these other branches, you impose loyalists who support your point of view. And then you weaponize the bureaucracy so that you can threaten your political opponents. And then we know that usually elections are the least ones to be under attack. So the moment you hear that this country is still a democracy, which we heard about Hungary, for example, for a very long time, that you are in democracy because you still have elections, right? But as I tried to explain in the beginning, it's like elections is an essential part of democracy, but it's not the only factor that defines whether you are a democracy or not, because to be a true liberal, stable democracy, it also matters how democracy functions between elections. To what extent the executive is accountable to the population, to other branches, and to the civil society, and to the media between elections, not only during elections. The pattern that we see, again, Viktor Orban is, Fico is also very common in that's what is called executive aggrandizement. So all the power is gradually concentrated in the executive in one person or a small group of people. And this has become a very, very common pattern, not only in Europe, of course, also in other countries, but most prominently also in Europe.
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned Robert Fico there in Slovakia, because I think you mentioned how many of these trends are driven by populist right-wing parties. But in his case, his party is a literal direct descendant of the Czechoslovakian Communist Party. And considering this is the region where, within living memory, people still struggled under a totalitarian regime under these heavy circumstances, the fact that it's the same people now, obviously in different variants in different countries, but they're asking basically to go backwards towards that direction, I think in one sense is a bit mind-boggling to me. But it also demonstrates to me just how, I guess you could say, there all these trends are dangerous and just affecting so many places that people wouldn't have expected, including, as you mentioned, Western Europe. There's a few countries in particular, the UK and Italy, that you flagged in the 2026 report. This is despite, according to your metrics, Western Europe and North America still remaining the most democratic of the different global regions. But despite that, as your report says, there have been significant drops that haven't been observed in this region in a while. What are the trends working? It's obviously not the same thing as urbanization, as you said, but what kind of trends are factoring into this drop in Western Europe as well?
It's more or less the same trends, honestly. So I wouldn't kind of single out Viktor Orban as something very, very specific for Eastern Europe. So unfortunately, the rhetoric that we see from the Meloni government, for example, is quite similar. You know, they pick up on different issues, of course. As I said, it's always very context specific, which specific problems you have in the society. And that's the one that the populist leaders pick up. The rhetoric they use, the restrictions on freedom of the media, restrictions on civil society. And so it's quite similar. The only difference that in Italy, it's in its very, very early stages. So it hasn't gone as far as Viktor Orban has gone. But again, it's very, very similar in my understanding. In the United Kingdom, the situation is somewhat different because the decline in the United Kingdom is fully driven by the decline in freedom of expression. Everything else, when we look at data, everything else stays stable. So we see no erosion of other democratic institutions. So it's only freedom of expression. And in my understanding, And we are not the only organization to notice it, because when we saw the data, we also consulted with our partners in Article 19, which is a human rights-based organization based in the United Kingdom. They are the one who are explicitly doing the research only on freedom of expression. And they raised concern about eroding freedom of expression in the United Kingdom already in 2025. And they even wrote a report and this notice that went back to the UK government about how bad it has become, and that it's the lowest level in over 20 years, which our data shows it's even worse than that. It's more than 20 years that the freedom of expression is at its lowest level. And we see that it's not only the government that is censoring the media, there is also self-censorship from the media, which can be partly explained by all the rising polarization within the society about certain issues, such as, for example, the situation between Israel and Gaza and all those things, where many, many medias are now trying to self-censor and not to touch upon this issue because it has become very, very dangerous. So at the moment with the United Kingdom, we are very careful, you know, with claiming that there is any similar pattern to what we see in the rest of Europe with executive aggrandizement, because as I said, it's only freedom of expression that's declining. Everything else remains relatively stable. There are unfortunately other countries that are so far not autocratizing, according to the data, but where we see some worrying trends, like rising polarization in the society, some erosion of freedom of expression. And they are also countries that are now on the watch list in democracy reports, somewhere you have some marginal declines in also in Western Europe. As you know, I mean, far-right parties, they're everywhere. It's also in France, Marine Le Pen prominently, AfD is on the rise in Germany. So it's not a new trend. So those parties are very, and they gain more and more support in Europe, which is very, very dangerous. And the only reason is that they so far are not they're not now leading the government. So they are not kind of the major party. So that's what saved those countries from, I think, executive aggrandizement at the moment, while in Italy they came to power.
And I'm glad you touched on that, and I'll get to that in a little bit later. But speaking of Italy, you mentioned Giorgia Meloni. I think it's timely with the recent referendum they had in Italy that failed, which everybody was, of course, seeing as a sign on whether more executive power would be transferred over. And it's one thing for a referendum to fail, that obviously shows that there is still power in the democratic structure, but at the same time that the question was even made a referendum in the first place, as you mentioned, it does show signs of similar trends as what we're seeing in Eastern Europe, in a sense. But touching in, you mentioned France and Germany, as you said, the parties didn't necessarily get power yet. But at the same time, at least as far as democratic functioning goes, with the ability of creating a stable government and having elections actually bring government, France has obviously been in its parliamentary crisis for months now. Belgium and the Netherlands have had similar issues. You mentioned Germany and Austria, even. They have there are parties that are being democratically, you could say, voted in. but they stand for very undemocratic ideals. And as with the case with Fico and his party, even have, in some cases, like the Freedom Party in Austria, even have links to the autocratic regimes of the previous century, in this case, the Nazi regime. Those countries, obviously, they haven't necessarily, according to your statistics, had a drop yet. But is there a cause for concern that this is an option or even likely going into the future?
Well, again, just to explain, our data only measures what's already happening, so we are not making any predictions about what might happen. And the only thing that we see in the data that the government that are currently in those countries, they maintain democratic system and democratic institutions. So as I said, both France, Germany, and Austria, and Belgium and Netherlands, the countries that were mentioned, they are very, very stable on democracy index so far. The problem that we see, and that's something that doesn't go into the index itself, it's a different measure within the VDOM data set, is the rise in polarization. And that explains quite a lot about why the support for those parties is growing, and which is, of course, may become dangerous if they get to power. And there was a separate research done by my colleagues here in the VDOM Institute, who analyzed which parties during the last 25 years were driving this decline. And usually it's right-wing extremist populist parties. So there are some exceptions. So as you mentioned with Slovakia, it's a very diff might be a bit different. Like we know also, for example, in Mexico now it's driven by left-wing party, but they are exceptions. So usually the typical pattern would be a right-wing extremist party, similar to AfD in Germany, who drive this, this agenda for very, very autocratic government. The difference again, if we may touch upon slightly with the United States, for example, we see that this idea about right-wing has become very, very dangerous when you have only a two-party system. It's one of the discussions that we also had, and we were analyzing countries that managed to, to make a U-turn and like to get those right-wing extremist parties out of power once they get to power. For example, the case of Poland, and one of the things that saved the country from a breakdown and saved the democracy from collapse was this multi-party system. Because if you have this dangerous situation when one right-wing extremist party rises and gets a lot of attention, what helps to stop those aspiring autocrats is a coalition of all other parties against a right-wing extremist who is trying to get to power. This is very difficult if you have a two-party system like in the United States.
So, originally, with my academic background, I studied the circumstances leading up to the Holocaust. And at least one of the reasons why I look into this subject is because if you look at what happened in the 1920s and the 1930s, you had similar polarization between the fascists and the communists. And even if somebody thinks maybe one side is less wrong than the other, well, they're both wrong. But even if one side thinks one side is less wrong than the other, the fact that that polarization is there in the first place shows that society is experiencing similar trends and going through similar, I guess you could say, transformations. And with what you brought up with in the United States within the two-party system, one of the ideas that used to be on the fringe and is now getting mainstream to the point where the party is afraid of even confronting it at this point is the idea, say, that Jews control world politics or other issues like that. But I think the big difference between the 1930s and now is that, in general, the big trends were mainly about things going on in one particular country. There were obviously other issues in other places, but I think it's safe to say the Holocaust wouldn't have happened if World War II happened or didn't happen. But now you're seeing the exact same trends happening basically worldwide, including, as you mentioned, in places that normally were considered bastions of the democratic system. In general, with circumstances like these, obviously, again, different countries are Some countries are stronger, some countries are weaker in keeping the systems going. Are there good chances or other otherwise ways that different societies and generally can reverse these trends, or are these signs more worrying than that?
We are very, very careful with making any predictions about the future. But again, looking at cases that managed to successfully reverse the trend, we know that there is a combination of factors. First, you need strong institutional factors. You need mostly the judiciary, but also to a certain degree, the legislative branch that protects the institutions, but usually it's the judiciary who stand up eventually and do not allow executive aggrandizement, who protect the constitution. And then you need also a collective societal action, and that's a combination of factors. First, the opposition parties all need to unite against an autocratizing government, as it happened in Poland, for example. A coalition, often coalescing also with civil society actors working on the ground. You need mass mobilization, but also sustained mobilization, something that we saw in South Korea, for example, where millions of people were on the streets at the same time in Seoul, demonstrating for months and demonstrating for and protecting their democratic system. And then also the final factor is that you usually need to act relatively fast, because if you look at successful cases of reversal, it usually happened at the end of the first electoral cycle. So the first elections that you have the moment those autocratic wannabe dictators come to power is that the first elections are usually decisive. Sometimes it happened at the second election, as in Poland. But again, looking at data, if you wait for more than two electoral cycles, if they manage to stay in power, then the probability of removing them remains like low and low. So it's a decade is usually enough to establish a relatively stable autocratic regime.
About 30 years ago, as I'm sure you've heard, there was the famous quote from Francis Fukuyama that the prediction was that we reached the end of history, that communism has fell, the liberal democratic system has been proven as the way forward, and that everything is just going to get better and better for the rest of the world as time goes on. Now, Mr. Fukuyama's walked back those comments recently, but those, I think, were, it's fair to say, there were a lot of people thinking similar things at the time. But last year, for your 2025 report, the title was 25 Years of Autocratization, and you've mentioned that it's been a general trend for the past quarter of a century. So it sounds like even before people realized that this was a, or I guess you could say the public at large realized that this is a problem, the signs, according to the data, as you were saying, were already there for a very long time. What happened?
25 years ago, no one could have predicted that it would become a wave. So if you look at the data for the last 125 years, there were always some countries were autocratizing or democratizing. So it's something that I think it's just a nature of thing that no regime is ever stable, right? So there are some periods where it gets better or worse. So 25 years ago, the only thing that seemed to be more or less visible in data that there was some decline in countries that are democratizing. So, but this reversal of the trend was still not on the agenda. And then one of the reasons that we also didn't have good data to measure at that moment 25 years ago, there was still this binary distinction between democracy and autocracy that was widely used. So Vidim was not there, Freedom House was there, but still not, again, not that widely used. And then the first signs we started to notice some first signs around 2010 or so. But again, like at that moment, it seemed like those countries an exception, because the very first leaders who, when we are thinking about who were the first leaders of the third wave who were driving this decline, it's most prominently Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. who started to dismantle democracy already at the end of 90s, beginning of 2000, then Vladimir Putin in Russia, then Erdogan in Turkey in 2005, then Orban in Hungary. But at that moment, the discussion was they are the exceptions. It cannot happen anywhere else. There is a very specific combination of factors that are driving this decline. And then when Vidom report, the first one, it came out, I don't remember the year, but it was some in the middle of 2015 to 16, to 17, somewhere when this first claim was made that the world is going in the wrong direction. At that moment, we were named alarmist. You know, it was, oh, this is such an alarming, you know, prediction that that's not what's happening. It's only individual countries that are declining. In 2019, my boss with Stefan Lindberg, with Anna Luhrmann, they published this very famous article, The Third Wave of Autocratization is Here. And again, the discussion right there was, oh, this is not the global trend. This is something that is very, very alarmist. You should be very careful with how you manage democratic backsliding and so on. But then already in 2020, the data on whatever indicator, whatever measure you use for democratic backsliding in the world, it started to show very statistically significant decline globally. And then if you look at the map already there, it was clear that it is a global trend. So it's not something that specific countries or specific regions are affected. It's happening everywhere. And then I think the moment people really realize the seriousness of this, and there are no major concerns, you know, I think it's when it reached the United States. It finally, everyone realizes that's not an exception. It's really serious. It's really a global trend. It can happen anywhere. No democracy is fully immune from these threats. Even the most developed ones are not immune and not fully protected. So I think now no one is doubting it at this moment. And even those who were criticizing both Vidom Institute and Freedom House, who raised this alarm about a decade ago, they were also raising this alarm. So we were not, again, the only ones. I think now there is no disagreement anymore. And then again, the second thing, I think that we are not the only one who are measuring democracy, right? And so we use our own methodology, but there are also other well-known institutes like Freedom House or Economist Intelligence Units. And all three major independent institutes show you that it is a global trend. You know, it's an agreement, academic agreement, agreeing on everyone who measures democracy. So it's something very serious and something that needs to be taken seriously.
For our viewers, if anybody would like to follow VDEM, the VDEM Institute more, if there's any other resources, could you recommend for people to go look for online or elsewhere?
I would, of course, recommend everyone to visit our VDEM.net page where you can access VDEM dataset. You can access the Vidom Institute Democracy Report, of course, but we also have online graphing tools. So you can easily see what's happening with democracy in any country in the world. Also zooming in into specific indicators or specific sub-indices that are declining. And you can also produce your own graphs using online graphing tools.
Dr. Marina Nord, thank you so much for appearing on our program.
Thank you.
That was again Marina Nord with the Varieties of Democracy Institute based in Gothenburg, Sweden. Thanks again for their participation. Europe's democratic erosion is a major trend that the Trumpet has been watching since our founding. Some of the material we discussed with Marina helps illustrate what democratic backsliding, erosion of civil liberties, etc. looks like on the ground, and puts what's going on in these individual countries in a continent-wide context. If anybody would like to learn more as to why the Trumpet watches this particular direction, we have two trends articles that we could put a link in the show notes that can help elaborate and go more in depth. That's all the time we have on today's show. I'd like again to thank Marina Nord and the VDEM Institute for their participation. Thank you also to Mr. Richard Palmer for allowing me to sub for you today, to George Haddad for engineering and production. I miss that guy. And thank you to you, the viewer, for coming on today's program. We'll be back with our Friday program as usual. Until then, keep watching your world.